okie
Okay, so my name is Bernard and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Jim, for the intro. It is always wonderful to be able to do service work with you, like Stutzman. So my sobriety date is May 9th, 2006. And I have a home group, which is Wake Up Call, which post-pandemic, we remained in virtual mode. So we continue to meet online Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7:15 in the morning. I have a sponsor and I have gone through the steps. So I guess those are some of my credentials. As Jim mentioned, usually, let me see, probably 46 weekends of the year, I am on the road during the weekend in different cities, someplace across the states. And it just so happened that when Jim reached out to me, I knew that this week and next week were actually vacation weeks for us. I'm not being sent out. And so it was a perfect opportunity that I was able to say yes to this opportunity. You know, usually I don't sort of give a context of my life when I share. You know, the details are sort of out there. But when we were at Stutzman last month, I shared with that group because, and I don't even remember what the context was, but it was appropriate to share the fact that I am a Roman Catholic priest. And that's something I just take for granted. You know, I mean, that's been part of my existence for priesthood for 45 years, religious life before that, another 10. So, you know, that's always been part of my story, which I never, I guess I don't consider it to be exceptionally important in a sense. But I discovered last month that it was important, and it provided an opportunity to be of service in a different way. But it got me thinking as well. And what I began to think of was the fact that my priesthood, my being a religious, is very much a part of my story. And why, perhaps, it took me as long as it did to get into the program. So, my story is, you know, it's really rather, and this is, see, this is also part of my problem, that my problem, my dilemma. When I share that my story seems so, oh, I don't know, so bland, you know. We had a speaker at Stutzman this last week, and you know, his story is really powerful. I mean, but it means, you know, sitting in a dark basement, smoking crack, drinking booze, and literally, absolutely literally rock bottom. And I always think for someone for a place like Stutzman, that's a great story, and I don't have that. But I also have come to understand that I have whitewashed a lot of my memory. That my drinking years, while I consider them to be benign, are anything but. Except that I was able to maintain my employment. I was able to continue my life. I was able to operate, without any interruptions in my ordinary life. And all of that gave me the impression that I had my crap together. So I did not start drinking until I was in my 20s. I went to the seminary when I was 18. I was the typical pleaser child. I always relate very, very strongly to the descriptions in the 12 and 12 about, let's talk about what kind of alcoholic you are, or let's see if you're an alcoholic. And when it describes the intellectually self-sufficient, that's my story. School was very easy for me. I performed well in school. I was a rule follower. And I moved, I moved forward in those circles. But always at the back of my mind, as I think of it now, there was always this idea that I needed to prove something. Because I wasn't the top in the class. I wasn't, the best in most things. I was good, but I wasn't the best. And somehow that wasn't enough for me. So, go to the seminary, and it was a very restrictive environment, et cetera. So drinking was not, I did not drink at all, actually. Maybe wines once in a while, but that was it. At like formal dinners or something like that. But then I was sent to Rome to study. And it was while I was in Rome where wine was on the table, obviously, at every lunch and dinner. That my drinking began, my drinking history really began. Because what I discovered was that and again, it's in hindsight that I can see that when I drank, I almost always tended to drink alcoholically. So I didn't sip, I gulped. And generally, I would say, that was okay because mealtimes I didn't drink outside of mealtimes. So even if I had more than others at the table, it wasn't that I got drunk. But it did establish the pattern of my drinking that I would see later on. And it didn't, it the drinking never got me into trouble at all while I was in Rome. But I knew that there were times when I certainly did have, I wasn't drunk, but I certainly was impaired. Okay. But fine, finished my studies, and that's when I came to Buffalo. And I came to Buffalo in 82. I was sent to Hilbert College in Hamburg, and I was a professor and campus minister there, and would be for the next 25 years. There, after a couple of years, 1 or 2 years, I became friends with individuals who were able to drink a lot. I would say in other circles, I mean, if you looked at the amount of booze that they drank, you'd think they were alcoholics, but I really don't think they were. I think they just had an enormous capacity for alcohol, because I never saw any of them drunk. But that started this pattern, because I could keep up with them, except it affected me as it did not affect them. And for a couple of years, that was okay. But over the course of time, and so that would have been, let me see, probably 84. So I didn't get sober until 2006. But there were indications that my life was being affected. And this is where I tend to whitewash my history, because I look back on those years and I don't remember, or I choose not to remember, sort of it's blocked out, the times that I had fender benders. I had blackouts while driving, stopping at a stoplight, or at a red light, and falling asleep. Coming back, because of course, like any good alcoholic, I knew I could drive, right? When I was plastered, I knew I could drive. I was fine, and nobody could tell me differently. But what that, so I got through, those incidents, and at one point, and this is, I don't remember dates. This is, part of the thing. But probably in the 90s, early 90s, I was coming back from a celebration, driving through the village of Hamburg, and got into an accident. I think I probably blacked out. Moved, I was at a stop sign, and then I probably woke up and moved forward and rear-ended someone, a tap, but nevertheless. So the cops came. I was issued a ticket. And I did not suffer a lot of consequences from that. Went to court in Hamburg Village, and I No one knew about it. I was able to keep this quiet. And I came away with, I forget how many hours of community service, of my, I don't think I had my license wasn't suspended, but it was a fine. And community service, and I was mandated to go to AA meetings. Being a good alcoholic who did not believe himself to be, I basically forged all of that. I got someone to sign off on the community hours service. Easy enough to do when you live in a house where guys are working in a high school and they, community service, et cetera, was able to do that. I probably forged the AA meeting slips. And my life went back to normal. My problem, in a sense, was that I could stop for periods of time. I could go, months, like 9, 10 months without drinking. But when I drank, I never, ever knew when I would get drunk. It was, in fact, like playing Russian roulette. I think it was probably 2 years later, driving back from Buffalo to Hamburg after, being drunk. I don't even know why I was followed, but the state troopers followed me on Route 5. Pulled me over, took me to the, I was arrested again for DWI. Took me to the station by in Cheektowaga, off of the 33 in Cheektowaga there, that substation, where, again, they processed me. I was trying to call a friend to get a ride back. Wasn't answering. And so I convinced them to let me just take a cab, home. Well, I took a cab, but I took a cab back to my car, got the car and drove home. I mean, this is the craziness of, if they had followed me, they'd arrested me again. They would have, but that, of course, didn't register. And the reason I'm sharing all of that is that there was in my mind somehow a belief that the rules didn't apply to me. But when I went to court, and okay. So I got a lawyer. This time, again, I'm living in a house of other priests and everything. They have no clue. Okay, all of this it's without any publicity whatsoever. I get to court. I go to a lawyer, who is a friend of. He's pro clergy kind of thing. Arranges it to have the case transferred to county court because he knew that the judge would be more amenable. Arranged it so that I was not in my case was not brought before the court in regular session, but it was at the very end when he knew that there would be no reporters there. All of it so that it would not be publicly reported that this priest had been arrested. And that was part of my difficulty. This sense of entitlement, which I never believed that I had, is exactly what I had when it came to drinking, and especially drinking and driving. I go to court, I lose my license, was mandated to, to go, was on probation. I drove to probation every time. I parked on a different lot so that no one would see it, but I drove with a suspended license because I had to, or I thought I had to. I was stopped a third time, and that was on May the 9th, 2006. And I was going home from a college function. It had been a party, an awards dinner. And I suspect that someone from the college had called the Hamburg police because they followed me, or they stopped me. And it was in that moment, as the lights are going behind me, that I stopped the car, sat there, and as we all do, suddenly I became very sober. And I said, "Holy shit, I am an alcoholic." And it was that moment of clarity that allowed me to access this program. Once again, the cops did not arrest me. They called my superior and said, just take him home, et cetera, et cetera. But that put things into motion. That put things into motion for me to go to rehab. I had already been to one rehab. And that was after the second time. And I don't remember the circumstances, but my superior came and said, "We want you to go to this program, this 28-day program." Okay. So I went to this program in Maryland, and it was religiously oriented, Father Ashley's, I forget the name, but it was for both drugs and alcohol. So, and most of the people there were younger. And I became the star pupil, because of course I always perform well. So much so that other residents in the program were looking at me as another counselor. I was able to say everything that was right, everything that needed to be said. I was the perfect mimic of that. I said I was an alcoholic, but I never believed it. I said it because one had to say it. When I left that program, I gave away my big book because Lord knows I didn't need it. And I never went to a meeting, which of course was exactly what they said. When you go home, go to a meeting, right? Never went. Was able to stop drinking for a decent amount of time. But when I picked up, because I was convinced that, oh, now I had this, I could do it, went right back to the pattern that I had. And that pattern was the same. It was, I would go in a situation and I would say, I'll have one drink. Maybe 2 out of 5 times I could do that. But that was enough to convince me that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I could control it. Even though 3 out of 5 times I was drunk. So I was sent to a, I chose, I mean, I fully accepted. Here I went willingly. And I went to a program in Minnesota, which was specifically designed for priests and religious. It was a 3-month program. And the very first thing that we were told, as sitting with the director of the program, he said, you know, with alcoholism, the first thing that you lose is your spirituality. And for a priest, that's a pretty big thing to lose. And I realized that in many ways, I had a public persona and I had a private persona. The public still functioned well. You know, I was a college professor. I was a priest. In both of those roles, I performed well. But my spiritual life was pretty bankrupt. And it certainly was nothing that could sustain me. And so we began doing the steps. And over the course of 3 months, we worked through those steps. Had a counselor who was an excellent, just an excellent counselor. I learned that I had been living basically in fear. He didn't tell me this, but I had discovered it. And that I needed to change my life. So it happened that while I was in rehab, I was fired from my job at the college. I re received a voicemail message telling me I was fired. And surprisingly enough, there was I think, a sense of relief. By that time, I had become the provost of the college. It was a new president, and it was never going to work. So this took that out of my hands. And I began to trust God once again. You know, because as the literature said, if you place your trust in God, you can't be God. And I think I lived my life in many ways acting as if I were. And so I came out of rehab and I had arranged already for a sabbatical, which I took and did some coursework in New York City, became went to a daily meeting every morning at 7:30, really began working the program as I should have, so many years before. But it led me ultimately to a major decision in my life, to leave the religious community that I was part of for 30 some years and become affiliated with a diocese. And I had another, I was very, very lucky. God was very good to me. My transition was remarkably smooth. I had been working for a charitable organization as a fundraiser, priest fundraiser, for a number of years as a part-time basis. And the opportunity arose that I could simply switch my life and become a full-time, employee of the charitable organization, which is what the weekend travel is. And so for the past 20 years, I've been working with the same organization, 18 of those since sobriety, 18 of those as full-time. And I've discovered that I have not felt the need for a drink in all of those years. I've been very fortunate. But I also discovered that what I thought was sobriety was only the beginning. I mean, I knew I could not drink. That was not an issue. But how to live a sober life is a whole different thing. And I think as I continue growing in the program, hopefully, there are a couple of areas that become exceedingly important for me. One is trust. And that is the absolute trust that there is a higher power I call God, who is absolutely and totally in charge. And that even if I have anxiety about things, I never need to live in fear. And it's very easy for me to say that, but it's not always easy for me to live that. But the program and sharing each other's strengths and hopes, that has helped me to understand more about myself and the way in which I look at life. I think the biggest thing for me has been to try to grow in humility. And this program is a pretty good, a really good growth plan for humility. Because I discovered that my life was, in fact, lived in a fundamental funk of fear. I was afraid fundamentally people wouldn't like me. There was this sense of need for affirmation. And I think that came from my own inability to simply love myself as I was. And wherever that came from, and I'll never figure that one out, I think. The reality is that it was always, I needed to prove something. I needed to be recognized. I needed to be in the inner circle. And that's a very tiring way to live. Because everything then is taken personally, everything is a slight, everything is, it's just a lousy way to approach life. And this program has allowed me to walk through that growth in humility. And quite literally, to be able to Live in a healthy indifference. I taught philosophy, so I tend to think of it in philosophical terms, but the Stoics were really great in terms of their approach of philosophical apathy. Not indifference in the sense of not doing your best or anything else, but realizing that I am not in charge. And the only thing over which I am in charge is the way in which I allow things to affect me. And it was only in sobriety that I could begin to appreciate that. And it's only in sobriety that I can continue to grow in that. And, so my story in some ways is, it's unique, which is always why I always think to myself when I'm asked to speak, I really don't have a lot of relatable stuff simply because of my circumstances, but I understand that the path is the same. Circumstances under which we walk that path will be individually different. But we have the commonality of our disease and we have the commonality of our cure. And, that is what I can bring to the table today. So, there you have it.